faith and firearms, and the biblical, historical, and practical basis for self-defense. At this moment, there is a bill before Parliament that is seeking to remove self-defense as a legitimate reason for people to apply for a gun license. And for this reason, we're needing to focus on this and give people the understanding on the biblical, historical, practical basis for self-defense, because I think a lot of Christians are confused. 1 Timothy 5 verse 8 says, "But if anyone does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever." To fail to provide for your family is to deny the faith. Fathers and husbands are required by Almighty God to provide for their families. Now, of course, that must include providing food and housing and clothing and education and medical care, love and discipleship, of course, and spiritual guidance, but also protection. Because of what worth are all the other protections and provisions if you don't provide protection as well, especially in a violent society? Anyone who fails to provide for their family has denied the faith and is worse than an infidel, an unbeliever. In fact, I would go further. Those who refuse to protect the young are worse than an animal. What animal will not fight to protect its offspring? Do not play with a mother bear's cubs or a lion's cubs or any animal's young. They will fight to protect the young. It's the most natural thing of all. God has endowed his creatures with claws and talons and horns. These are incredibly sharp horns. I don't know if you've ever seen a gemsbok at work, but up at the border, one of our people, I don't know whether it was because he knew this or whether he was being mean, but he threw a tin at a oryx, a gemsbok, who just batted away with his horns like he's playing cricket. And then people start to bowl all sorts of things, and this oryx just batted them away. I mean, precision. And we thought, wow, we'd love him on our cricket team. God has given his creatures sharp teeth and tusks and stings and venoms and swift wings and other means for flight or fight or camouflage. There's so many different weapons that God has given his creatures. Self-defense is built into nature. I mean, just take porcupines. You don't want to mess with porcupine quills, and they can be really mean. Why would God then, if he's endowed all of his creatures with weapons for defense, expect his blood-bought children who are written in the Lamb's Book of Life to be defenseless doormats for the pagans to trample all over? The underlying arguments for gun control seem to be that the availability of weapons causes crime, but that is not the biblical position. Genesis 4 records the first murder when Cain killed Abel. Now, it doesn't tell us what weapon he used, but God's response was not to ban all knives or rocks or clubs or whatever the murder weapon may have been used. It doesn't even mention the murder weapon. God banished the murderer. It is the murderer's heart that is the problem, not the weapon used. And we can see this throughout the scriptures. The emphasis is on the heart of the murderer. In Genesis 9, verse 5 to 6, immediately after the flood, when Noah and his family and the animals came out of the ark, God instituted capital punishment for murder. "Whoever sheds man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God he has made man." This death penalty for murder was restated repeatedly in Exodus and Leviticus and Numbers and Matthew and Acts and Romans and Revelation. So it's not just Old Testament, it's New Testament, it's in the Gospels, it's all the way through. Capital punishment for murder. It's not a matter of opinion poll, it's a matter of God's law. However, nowhere does the Bible advocate weapons control. The Bible does record the control of weapons by the Amalekites and the Philistines in Judges 5 verse 8 and 1 Samuel 13, where they took control of all the blacksmith instruments, and so that the children of Israel were not able to even repair their tools without going to a Philistine or an Amalekite, because they had not just that sword control. And so if you needed your hoe or your spade to be repaired, you'd have to go to the Philistines because they wanted to be sure they controlled the means of having weapons. And we read that there was no sword in all of Israel except for King Saul and Jonathan. The rest had to just fight with farm tools. So weapons control is recorded in the Bible, but it's not recommended. It's a pagan attempt. It condemns these restrictions on individual defense as a pagan attempt to centralize excessive power. Our Lord Jesus Christ told his disciples at the Last Supper, "He who has no sword, let him sell his garment and buy one." And the context was plainly a real physical sword, because the Apostle Peter and another disciple produced two swords, and the Lord didn't rebuke him and say, "You don't understand what I'm talking about, I'm spiritualizing this." No. In fact, in the garden, the Apostle Peter drew his sword and doubtless was aiming not at the ear, but at the head of the servant Malthus. But Jesus didn't say, "Peter, what are you doing with a sword?" He just told him earlier, "You should have a sword." He tells him, "Peter, put your sword back in its sheath." Didn't say, "Throw the sword away." This is the wrong time. This is the wrong place. The Lord didn't need Peter's puny sword. The Lord, with a word, could have called on 10,000 legions of angels. He could have obliterated Jerusalem, all his enemies, the whole world, if he wanted to. He didn't need any puny weapon of man. But where he said, "In the past, I sent you out without cloak and bag. Now I'm telling you, if you don't take extra bags and extra food and supplies, and if you don't have a sword, sell your cloak and buy one." Why? Well, it's dangerous to travel. The Good Samaritan came across a man who was mugged on the road to Jericho. So these are realities. Jesus said, "If you don't have a sword, sell your cloak and buy one." The law of God is clear. The case laws of Exodus. Exodus 22 verse 2. "If the thief is found breaking in and he struck so that he dies, there shall be no guilt for his bloodshed." Now, this is talking about a thief. It's nighttime. You can't tell. You can't tell in the dark, is this just a thief? Is this a murderer? Is this a child abuser? In the dark, you strike out, you kill a person, there's no guilt for his blood. Now, that's for a thief. Not even a murderer. I mean, if a murderer or a rapist or a terrorist is threatening your family during the daylight, well, of course, it's got to be even more right to use deadly force. But this is giving a case law that at night, even if a thief is struck, such he dies. And, you know, when you bring the lights, you find, oh, he wasn't even armed. But there's no guilt because it's darkness and he shouldn't be breaking into your home at night anyway. The law of God establishes the basic right of self-defense. Any person is justified in defending himself or his family whenever they're attacked or their lives are endangered. Any weapon is permissible for use in self-defense. The law of God does not say that the homeowner is guilty if he uses a sword, but innocent if he uses a club. The issue is not a matter of what weapon is used. It's the right and the duty of self-defense. The Ten Commandments and the case laws of Exodus provide the foundations for freedom. To limit a person's access to lethal weapons is to limit his ability for self-defense and family defense. Gun control interferes with our basic right and responsibility for self-defense. And it's absolutely immoral in a time of rampant murder, especially targeting farmers, to bring in legislation limiting the ability of people to have weapons that they can use to defend themselves, when they'll often be outnumbered. The average farm attacker is outnumbered from 4 to 8 times. There's some attacks are with 12 or even 16 attackers. How can you expect a farmer to realistically defend his home and his family without access to firearms? Ultimately, gun control can deprive you of your right to life. And this is the sort of thing that tyrants do. They collect up weapons and they destroy private weapons so that people are vulnerable and defenseless, such as is happening right now in Burma, where the Buddhist military dictatorship is slaughtering Christians and Muslims alike in this Buddhist military dictatorship of Myanmar, what we used to call Burma. The right of citizens to use lethal force to defend themselves is a great deterrent to hijackers, rapists, and murderers. Those who choose not to have firearms still benefit from those who do. If even only 1 in 20 people are armed, it still acts as a restraint on potential attackers who are uncertain who is armed and who is not armed. So even if you choose not to have a firearm, you still benefit. The deterrent value of armed citizens against crime cannot be overestimated. In studies of convicted felons in prison, there's no doubt all the studies show what they fear the most is not the police. It's not dogs. Although dogs that bark and dogs that bite are a deterrent. It's alarm systems and electric fences they laugh at. I mean, that's pathetic, especially when you've got scheduled load shedding and power failures. These electric fences are completely a false sense of security. And, you know, people who are depending on electric fences are just not really thinking clearly about the whole situation. In fact, all you need to do is take a rubber mat and throw that over an electric fence. I mean, we practiced how to overcome obstacles, and electric fences are not that serious an obstacle for anybody who's vaguely determined. Anyway, what the felons, the convicted criminals, fear the most is an armed citizen and a chance that they could get shot by one of the victims they're targeting. Nehemiah 4 verse 14 is a clear command. Do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, great and awesome, and fight for your brethren, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your houses. From these and many other passages of Scripture, we can see that a man is responsible to be armed and to be prepared to protect his household. If he is not, then he doesn't deserve the title of a man, even though he may be a male. Proverbs 25 verse 26 says, a righteous man who falters before the wicked is like a murky spring and a polluted well. You go to a well, you're expecting fresh water. You can imagine if you've been in a desert like we've been up in just the southernmost point of the Sahara Desert, and you're in Nub Mountains, you get to a well. Imagine if that well is polluted. I mean, that's just disgusting. And so with a murky spring. Well, so it is when you find a person who gives way to the wicked. Pacifism is a deadly deception. Can anyone identify where this ridiculous, pathetic, out of all proportion monument is? We've got a small replica in the waterfront, but where's the original main big one? New York City in front of the United Nations building. Notice, this is not an AK-47 rifle barrel twisted. It's not an RPG. It's not a Panga. It's not any of the weapons that tend to be used by attackers and criminals. This is a civilian defensive weapon, a revolver. Not that there's a revolver on a planet that's got that long a barrel, but anyway. But why did they choose a revolver? Because it's a civilian weapon. It might be a police weapon. It might be a defensive weapon for a woman in particular who chooses revolvers more than anything else. But it's not a military weapon. It's certainly not a weapon that's preferred by terrorists. And so what the United Nations is saying is, we are out to disarm civilians. And that's what they're doing. Because let's face the United Nations as a bunch of gangsters with flags. Most of them are unelected. Most of them are illegitimate. They are mostly human traffickers, drug dealers, gangsters, dictators, mass murderers, persecutors of the church. They're enemies of God. And so no wonder they want to disarm the average citizen. Because they're involved in every kind of crime and villainy themselves. When these scriptural principles are ignored, the right of self-defense, the results can be tragic. I well remember when the Christians at Elam Mission Station in Zimbabwe, which was then Rhodesia, 1978, they were such convinced pacifists. These were English Pentecostal pacifist missionaries. Within a few kilometers of Marx of Mozambique, not 4 kilometers from a communist country, they refused to be armed. They had neither fence nor dogs to protect them. They refused to allow the security forces to station some guards for their protection on a mission base. In fact, when communist terrorists of ZANU-PF, of Mugabe, visited their mission station, the missionaries always provided them with food and medical supplies, and so they grew to know the place, know the people, and they grew to have contempt for them too. And one fateful night in 1978, ZANLA terrorists of Robert Mugabe, under his direct orders and instruction, herded the 9 missionaries and their 4 children onto one of the fields. In front of the parents, they hacked the children to death. In front of the husbands, they raped and tortured the women to death. And finally, they brutally murdered the men. Yet so effectively had their pacifist beliefs neutralized them that these pacifist Pentecostal missionaries from England made no attempt at resistance. The men stood by and watched ruthless terrorists butcher and abuse their loved ones. In fact, I've spoken to some of the terrorists who were involved in this, who later were converted and were in a Salvation Army Bible College near Bulawayo. And they said they were on their knees praying for us while we killed their wives and children. Now that may sound great to some people, but I think like a murky spring in a polluted well, as a righteous man who gives way to the wicked. It is wrong. There's not an animal who would not fight for all they're worth to protect their young. In November 1987, a similar massacre took place at New Adams Farm in Zimbabwe. Their sincere belief in pacifism disarmed these 16 precious Christians and made them helpless victims to a frightful slaughter. The memorial service in Bulawayo shortly after, just a terrible, terrible experience of these people. And the people, if we've got the book downstairs, the author Bob Scott, Life and Death and Hope in Africa, Saving Zimbabwe. He wrote the book and came here and had a radio interview with him. Absolutely tragic. Such a lovely mission, such a wonderful work, such nice people. But pacifism had neutralized them to the point that they were just victims waiting for somewhere to happen. Our first board member of Frontline Fellowship, Father Arthur Lewis, is a missionary, first to Tanganyika and then to Rhodesia, and he gave his life to Africa. He wrote the book Christian Terror. He documented, he's the one who blew the whistle, that the World Council of Churches was taking church money, money donated in churches around Britain and America, and giving it to World Council of Churches, a program to combat racism, who handed it to terrorists like Zanla, ZAPU, Frelimo, SWAPO, MPLA, who butchered and killed Christians. And he documented this, and we've actually reprinted this book, and we've even made it a free PDF book available online because it was out of print. This was so important. This actually got, back in 1976 when it came out, Reader's Digest published it. And that was very widely read. That was sold at the checkout tills of Pick and Pays and so on. All over the world, people were reading on this. And this led the Baptists to pull out of the World Council Churches. It led Salvation Army to pull out of World Council Churches. So it was a very effective book to expose the fact that the mainline churches represented by the World Council Churches have been so infiltrated, neutralized at the top, that their top leadership were literally funding the terrorists who were murdering their missionaries, killing their Christians, herding Christians into churches and burning it down around them in Zimbabwe, amongst other places. And funding the terrorists like Nkomo's ZAPU, who shot down with Soviet heat-seeking missiles two viscounts within Rhodesia and then killed and ate the survivors on one of those occasions. And Rhodesia was on the front line fighting against communist terrorism in the 1960s and 70s. English legal tradition has always recognized the right of free citizens to possess and carry weapons for self-defense. King Alfred the Great, the only English king called great, laid the foundations for English law. The Ten Commandments of Exodus 20 formed the preamble to these laws. So the common law of England, the dooms of King Alfred, begin with these words. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the house of bondage, out of the house of slavery in Egypt. You ought to have no other gods before me. And the whole Ten Commandments, case laws of Exodus, Sermon on the Mount, golden rule of Christ, that forms the foundation of the English common law. Now, amongst the law, the dooms of King Alfred, it would fine abuses like drawing a sword in a meeting and disrupting a meeting, but the basic right to bear arms was entrenched. The laws of King Canute, the Viking king of England, declared that self-defense was not only your right, it was your duty. And those who failed to assist a person under attack were to be fined. This walking by on the other side of the road, totally unacceptable. You see somebody under attack, you are duty-bound to defend them, or you will be punished, you'll be prosecuted. Similarly, anyone who illegally disarmed a man was to be fined. Magna Carta, the Great Charter of 1215, the first written restriction of the powers of government, and the grandfather of all bills of rights, guarantees the right of all free men to keep and to bear arms. Now, Magna Carta is meant to be the rock-solid foundation of England. It builds on the common law of England, which is based in Ten Commandments, written by King Alfred the Great and the laws of Canute, but it built even further on it, and it entrenches in there, amongst other things, the right of all free men to keep and to bear arms it was not to be infringed. And so when Americans have said that their Second Amendment is the first statute that entrenched its right, no, it was consciously copied and built upon Magna Carta. In fact, the American colonists who were rebelling against England in 1776 did it on the basis that their chartered rights as Englishmen, as guaranteed by Magna Carta, were being violated by the British government. They were paying taxes, but they weren't getting the representation. They were in allegiance to the King of England, but he was not protecting their rights, as he was sworn to do at his coronation oath, to uphold Magna Carta. And so they were saying, our chartered rights as Englishmen are being violated. We are not being given the benefits of Magna Carta. The English Declaration of Rights of 1689 recognized the right of having and using arms for self-preservation and for defense. In fact, the English Bill of Rights of 1689 expressly mentions the right of all free men to have firearms, which, of course, Magna Carta couldn't have because it predates firearms in 1215. And all this long predates the American Bill of Rights. So these are the grandfathers of all Bill of Rights. Other free states have entrenched this right to obtain, to own, to carry, to use weapons for self-defense. Most notably, the United States of America, its Bill of Rights, it's the Second Amendment to keep and bear arms. If these foundational principles for freedom seem extreme or outdated, let's consider some recent examples. Rwanda was a gun-free zone. I went to a meeting in Mowbray some years ago with Gun-Free South Africa, and there they were talking about it. I think Reverend Peter Story was one of the leaders, and he said, can anyone mention a country which has had a gun-free policy that we advocate? And I said, yes, Rwanda. You could see they thought, that's not an example you're thinking. And then Soviet Union, Cambodia. And so we actually had about a third of the people there were our people, and they quickly stopped the discussion. It was advertised, a public discussion. They suddenly cancelled discussion time, ended the meeting early because it wasn't going the way they wanted. On the 6th of April, 1994, one of the most dreadful campaigns of mass murder was unleashed on the Tutsi people, a minority tribe in Rwanda. In just over 6 weeks, more people were killed with machetes, pangas, and clubs than have died from atomic weapons in all of history. I mean, think about that for a moment. Atomic weapons were horrific, but pangas killed more people in Rwanda in 6 weeks than atomic bombs have ever killed in all of history combined. The MRND Hutu government of Rwanda instigated and organized and launched the systematic slaughter of the Christian Tutsi tribe, often forcing a rigorous gun control, which was aided by the United Nations. The United Nations came in and helped them disarm the people and basically enabled the genocide, obviously unknowingly, but that was the effect of it. Romeo Dallaire's book, Shake Hands with the Devil, and it's turned into a film now too, is a heartrending expose on the failure of, well, the book says, the failure of humanity in Rwanda. I would call it the failure of the United Nations in Rwanda. But this is a man who really believed in the United Nations. Romeo Dallaire, Canadian general in charge of, well, he is the military head of UNIMIR, the United Nations mission in Rwanda, but he was under Kofi Annan. Kofi Annan was the head of the Security Council. He was his direct superior, and Kofi Annan prevented him from doing his duty. And he says one of the greatest regrets of his life is that he didn't disobey his orders. He would have spent the rest of his life in prison, but he could have at least had a clear conscience that he had done what he could to save lives, because the United Nations didn't just do nothing. They actually handed over people who were in their camps for protection over to the Interahamwe mass murderers, who hacked them to death within sight of the gates. And next they came with another list of journalists, pastors, and other troublemakers, and the UN found them, brought them out, and they were slaughtered. And this happened time and time and time again. I took this picture at Natarama Church, 1,200 corpses in one church building. And the heads, the skulls of some of the victims actually on the altar. As the population had previously been disarmed, they were helpless to defend themselves against a state which had a monopoly of weapons. Over 800,000 Tutsi Christians were murdered. The confiscation of weapons made the massacres possible by disarming the targeted victims. In fact, every genocide of the 20th century began with gun registration, gun control, gun confiscations. And I know it's a horrible thing to note, but just observe, those aren't bullet holes in those skulls. Those are the results of knobkerries. They're cracking skulls with knobkerries. It's clubs. And you can see some of the marks from machetes. At the Holocaust Museum in Kigali, which I've been to, they've got the pictures of the victims, because that's the most important thing, that you don't forget the victims, that you give them a face, that you don't let the names be forgotten. It's important that we remember, as at the Anglo-Boer War Museum in Bloemfontein, at the Women's Monument, that they've got the names of all the Boer women and children who died in the concentration camps, the dates, the names, the places, that you don't forget. And it's such a shocking thing to go to Bloemfontein and see that, because there are 6 times more names on the women's monument as there are on the men who died in the battle. What war do the women and children die at a 6 times greater rate than the men? And that was the first war of the 20th century. It just showed the way wars were going, from soldiers fighting soldiers to soldiers targeting civilians, which is horrific. And that's what happened in Rwanda too. The Holocaust in Rwanda again confirmed that limiting the ability of law-abiding citizens to defend themselves and defend their family is an open invitation to criminals to attack the innocent. That's why I put the subtitle in my book, The Roles of Gun Control, Media Manipulation, Liberal Church Leaders in the United Nations. And that's a scandal all on its own. Gun control precedes genocide. Every genocide of the 20th century has been preceded by gun control. Starting with the Christian Armenians in Ottoman Turkey from 1915 to 1917. It was preceded by first registering all the guns and then confiscating them all, and then they could target the defenseless. And the Armenian genocide is still to this day not recognized by Turkey. Turkey is guilty of genocide, and they have just like swept it out of the history books like it never happened. And it wasn't just the 1.5 million Armenians. There's 750,000 Assyrian Christians and 950,000 Greek Orthodox Christians slaughtered at the same time period by the Ottoman Turkish Empire. This is the memorial in Armenia, which is an independent country of its own, up in the mountains of Ararat, roughly where Noah's Ark ended up after the flood, and the oldest Christian country in the world. Dates back to the 2nd century that Armenia embraced Christ as a kingdom. The massacres of Christian farmers, the kulaks as they call them, in the Soviet Union from 1919 to 1953 were preceded by gun control and gun confiscation. The genocide against Christians in Red China from 1949 to 1976 preceded by gun control. The genocide against the Christians in Uganda 1971 to 1979 under Idi Amin, it was preceded by confiscating their firearms. And this was liberation in Uganda under Idi Amin, a brutal, sadistic criminal who was made head of the African Union, Organization of African Union, the chairman of the African Union, was given standing ovations at the United Nations while he was slaughtering his people. He even killed the Archbishop of the Church of England in Uganda and cooked and ate him. The genocide against educated people in Cambodia from 1975 to 1979, the killing fields of Cambodia, preceded by gun control legislation, which effectively disarmed the targeted victims. What has been the greatest kill in all of history? A gun-free sticker would not have helped any of these people, because the greatest threat to life is not from firearm accidents. It's not even from criminals. In fact, the greatest killer in the 20th century was not even war, not even counting the First and Second World War. The greatest killer in the 20th century has been secular governments who'd first disarmed their citizens. Historian Paul Johnson observed the 20th century has proven itself the greatest killer of all time, the 20th century state, what he called the rise of the gangster states. The 20th century saw the worst atrocities ever committed and the largest amounts of people ever killed. In fact, do you know, more Christians were killed for their faith in the 20th century than all previous 19 centuries combined. The 20th century is the worst century in the history of the world for the church and for religious freedom. There's never been a worse century. And if you believe in evolution, that the world's getting better and better, well, 20th century should knock that one out of the park, because in the 20th century, we saw devolution, degeneration, not progress. Approximately 160 million people were killed by their own governments in just 40 communist states just in the 20th century alone, documented by the Black Book of Communism, which is written by ex-communists. Stéphane Cortez, who's the editor of it, was the editor of Communisme magazine in France. All these six people were Communist Party members in France. They all left the Communist Party after the files were opened. And just taking from the documentation of the communist states alone, especially in Russia and Eastern Europe, of course, they didn't have access to China's or many of the other communist countries' files because they haven't been opened yet. But from Russia's files and the ones from East Germany and Romania, they documented 100 million killed just in Eastern Europe and Russia in the 20th century. Now, Professor Rommel, Death by Government, goes much wider and further. And he takes the number to over 169 million. These were not foreigners killed by invading armies during times of war. These were citizens killed by their own governments in times of peace. So if people give you the impression that your biggest threat is the coronavirus or firearm accidents or war, no. Statistically, the greatest threat to life are governments. Secular governments who have taken the Bible and prayer out of parliament and out of the schools and who don't want the Ten Commandments in a school and don't want Christianity in a classroom and they want to teach situation ethics and evolutionism. That's just the beginning. Then they want to disarm the people. What comes after that when the people are disarmed? Whatever they want. The 20th century was the bloodiest century in all of history, and humanism has proved to be the most destructive religion of all time. Far more people have been killed in the name of atheism than by all other religions combined. And remember, we've only had atheist countries since 1917. So even comparing to the millenniums before that, the atheist state has proved to be the biggest killer and the most destructive religion in the history of the world and the most intolerant. Fact. Romans 3, their throat is an open tomb. With their tongues they've practiced deceit. The poison of asps is under their lips, whose mouth is full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Destruction and misery are in their ways. The way of peace they have not known. There is no fear of God before their eyes. You see, just like criminals prefer unarmed victims, tyrants prefer unarmed citizens. Gun control deprives potential victims of their best means of protection. A free people need to be armed. Disarmed people can be easily exploited and oppressed, like in Red China today. If the government does not trust its citizens with weapons, then the citizens cannot trust that government with power. How do you control a nation? You distract them. You deceive them. You divide them. You indoctrinate them. And then you disarm them. This has been the way of tyrants all over the world. And we are at this point. Our government in this country wants to disarm the population. And of course, we've got to resist. And by the way, we have resisted and we've won before. Back in 1999, as Thabo Mbeki became president, he tried to rush through Parliament the Firearm Control Act 2000. And Charles and I mobilized marches to Parliament, protests, radio, rallies. We launched a magazine, Firearm News, which we published from this mission base here. We did so much around in going to Parliament, submissions, arguing. I took my documentation, 1,200-page documentation of Holocaust Rwanda, dropped it on the table so it made a thud, made them all jump, pointed out. And when they said, "Are you accusing us of planning genocide?" I said, "Yes." And there was a silence in this room. Why else would you want to disarm the population? And you know, you're trying to compare us with the Khmer Rouge? And yes, I am. And well, we won that battle, not through Parliament, but the Supreme Court said the whole Firearm Control Act was unconstitutional and scrapped it in its entirety. And yet, the government really tried to fight. They fought for years on this, but we won that battle through public and through lawsuits. And in fact, one of the groups that was launched at that time was GOZA, Gun Owners of South Africa. Now, there was SAGA, South African Gun Owners, Association, which I belong to, but they weren't being aggressive enough. So Charles and I launched GOZA, Gun Owners of South Africa, which was far more go for the throat, and did legal action and won in the Supreme Court, so that even people's old expired licenses were accepted by the Supreme Court as still valid, and said you cannot confiscate the property of 2 million licensed gun owners who haven't re-registered, and you cannot just turn millions of people in this country into criminals, and this isn't constitutional. And so, but that was a hard battle. So we won this battle 21 years ago, and now it's a new generation who doesn't know these arguments who need to learn them, because we're about to have to fight this battle again. But we've won it before, we can win it again. A government that fears its own people is itself to be feared. No government should ever have a monopoly of force or weaponry. Now, you just take in America every now and then to have some gun incident, which is often a false flag. Many times it's sponsored by the states itself. And then the Democrats start screaming, we've got to take away people's guns because of this or that, which often it turns out they were actually behind them. It was a black op false flag done by the very government themselves. This has been proven. If you doubt that, I've got the Christian Action Newsletter on false flag operations, where it's been proven how NATO staged terrorist actions against their own populations all across Europe. As America, CIA, planned terrorist operations on own populations in order to stampede the people into accepting more restrictions, more gun confiscations, and so on. So make no mistake, this has been proven. This isn't a theory. This is proven false flag operations, and I've got a whole series on that. We did that at a previous Reformation Society. There's videos and PowerPoints on that too, and articles. But when they talk about mass shootings, governments are the heavyweight champion of mass shootings. No one has killed more people than secular humanist governments, which is why the world has never seen celebrations like 1989, when the Berlin Wall came down and the idols of Lenin and Stalin and Marx were toppled, and when the Iron Curtain collapsed, and when the captive nations of Eastern Europe and Ethiopia and other places went free. Celebrations. Who will rise up for me against the evildoers? Who will make a stand for me against the workers of iniquity? Now, most here were too young for that battle, the Cold War and so on. But you've got a chance to be involved in a similar battle against a similar enemy today. They are just as evil, but unfortunately, the new generation has grown up either doesn't know about communism or the reality of it and what their agenda is, and that's why it's important for us to learn and to share this with others. So, now we get to firearms and missionaries. And this picture is taken in Nuba Mountains of Sudan. Pioneer missionary William Carey, whose landmark book, An Inquiry into the Obligation of Christians to Use Means for the Conversion of the Heathen, the book that launched the modern missionary movement, published in 1792. This listed under the fifth chapter, first page of the fifth chapter, under checklist of essential equipment for missionaries, knives, powder, and shot. I think you can take it that William Carey is not a pacifist. In fact, he took muskets to the field as just some of the most basic equipment to pack when you're going to the mission field. Pioneer missionary and explorer Dr. David Livingstone, when he landed in Africa, in Table Bay, on the 17th of March, 1841, he was well equipped with some of the finest, most advanced weapons of that day, including a six-barreled revolver and double-barreled rifle. Very advanced weaponry for that time. And he used them. On occasion, David Livingstone was compelled to use his weapons for protection from wild beasts and to persuade slave traders to set their captors free. He set thousands of captors free. At one point, after his party had been compelled to shoot back at slave raiders in the Shiri Valley of Malawi, Livingstone was criticized heavily for this, and he said, I love peace as much as any man. In fact, I'd go quite beyond you, for I love peace so much I would fight for it. And remember, the Bible says, blessed are the peacemakers, not blessed are the pacifists. Passivity and neutrality and apathy is the antithesis of Christianity. Christianity is action. Faith in action, doing what's got to be done. A peacemaker often has to take action. It doesn't just happen by sitting back and doing nothing. Faith and action go together. There's nothing incompatible with having faith and action. Missionaries such as these face dangers which we can hardly even imagine. We shouldn't be too quick to condemn and judge others for doing what the Bible commands us to do, which is take reasonable precautions for self-defense and for the protection of our families. Now, just like David going into the valley of the shadow of death against Goliath, he didn't put his faith and his trust in a sling. He took a sling. He took the weapon he is best knowing and most comfortable with. But as he said, you come with your shield, your spear, and your javelin. I come in the name of the Lord God of hosts, whom you have defied. So he put all his faith in the Lord, but he still took his weapon. Yes, of course, the primary weapons of missionaries are the Bible, prayer, faith, and persuasion. Of course. That's what we do every day of the year. Just as our primary spiritual food is the Word of God. But that doesn't stop us from planting seeds and harvesting crops and shopping and preparing food. Those are also essential too. Christians must be balanced. We need to recognize that sin comes from the heart of man. There's no point blaming a tool, a cold, metal, inanimate object for the evil that's in men's hearts. Does a flash drive make a hacker? Does a knife make a slasher? Does a lighter make an arsonist? Inanimate objects do not cause crime. The problem is not guns, it's hearts without God, it's homes without discipline, it's schools without prayer, and it's courts without justice. That's a good summary. Pacifism is in defiance of historic Christian teaching. The 39 Articles, the foundational statement of the Church of England, states clearly in Article 37, it is lawful for Christian men to carry weapons. How straightforward is that? The Westminster Catechism, considered the finest expression of biblical teaching, states under the sixth command that the prohibition against murder requires as our duty all careful studies and lawful endeavors to preserve the life of ourselves and others by resisting by just defense against violence, protecting and defending the innocent. This is the answer to question 135 in the Westminster Confession of Faith under the larger catechisms. And we should look at an example of excellence, Switzerland's strategy for survival. If you want peace, prepare for war. Peace is achieved through superior firepower. This sums up the Swiss attitude towards peace and freedom. I must say this is one of my favorite flags in the world. Just love it when you've got a plus on the flag. That's seriously positive. The land of William Tell, Ulrich Zwingli, William Farel, John Calvin, a great Reformation country, with its deep mistrust of central governments, with its abiding love for God's word and for life and liberty, remains a bastion of freedom. Somehow or another, Switzerland alone in Central Europe remained an island of sanity and peace and freedom during the two ruinous world wars when French, Italian, and Germans were killing one another by the millions. And even though their population consisted of German-speaking, French-speaking, Italian-speaking, yet they remained at peace through armed neutrality and through a decentralized government system. Through armed neutrality, they had the highest mobilization in Europe. More than any other population in Europe, Switzerland mobilized 80% of their manpower during the war. They didn't stay neutral just by saying, we're neutral. It was armed neutrality. They shot down aircraft that violated their territorial area. They shot down British aircraft, French aircraft, American aircraft, and German aircraft, all equally without partiality. Anyone who violated the airspace, they exchanged artillery fire with the armies of each of the belligerents at different times at the borders when they were maybe being tested. So they were very involved in the Second World War and the First World War, less so, there was less transgressions to their borders in the First World War. In the Second World War, they had to fight to maintain their border integrities. And they also had mined all of their bridges, all of their tunnels, and they made it clear, if anyone invades us, we're just going to collapse the tunnels and the bridges. You won't get very far. If you want to use us as a thoroughfare to get to wherever, it's not going to happen. And through the Alps, without those bridges and without those tunnels, it's going to take years to rebuild. So that's, and Switzerland still got it. They still got the mine tunnels and bridges all over. Shooting festivals are one of the most important unifying activities in the Swiss communities. Their stamps celebrate target shooting, because target shooting is their national sport. It starts at school. The children start with air rifles and they work their way up to the real things. And while all the men must serve in the army, if you are a woman and you want to shoot, the government will give you an assault rifle free and a case of ammunition each year. I mean, how's that? No wonder the country stays free. Who wants to compete against Switzerland when it comes to shooting? As the Americans noted in the First World War, the French infantry train at 40 yards, the British infantry train at 100 yards, the German infantry train at 300 yards, and the Swiss infantry train at 400 yards. And here's a 300-yard range in Switzerland, but I was on my way to a minister's conference back many years ago, back in 2005, and I took this picture. I saw, look at that shooting range here. You see the targets. I got close and thought, goodness me, it's a very narrow shooting range. I said, is that a pistol range? And my driver said, no, that's a rifle range. A rifle range? Where they shoot from? Oh, from the other side of the valley. How many countries would have a shooting range which goes over houses, cars, cows, fields, roads? And he said, well, we're good shots. And I said, well, I'm sure you are. This is why Switzerland has been an island of sanity and freedom, because of armed neutrality. Their people know how to fight, and every home is an armory, actually. So, I mean, Swiss rifles are just the best. And you can't defend a republic with chocolates and clocks alone. They make excellent clocks and chocolates, but their rifles, absolutely outstanding. It's always been Switzerland's high level of military preparedness, where they've got entire mountains hollowed out for airfields that literally land in mountains. They've got whole cities underground. They have the capability of putting 140% of their population in nuclear bomb-proof shelters for 10 years, fed, provided for, and everywhere. I mean, there's no country in the world as prepared as them. They take this seriously. A nation of sharpshooters on skis has proved an effective deterrent to would-be aggressors. Now, a bad workman blames his tools. If firearms caused crime, then Switzerland would be a violent, lawless country because every citizen has weapons of war stored in his home. For example, I was at a mission base in Switzerland, and in an apartment on this mission base, I looked across the table at a young man, and I said, are you in the army? And he laughed, and he said, of course, we're all in the army. I said, I believe you can get ready for war quite quickly. And he said, yes. I said, how long would it take? He said, I don't know. I said, can I time you? He said, when? I said, starting now. And 5 minutes, 19 seconds later, he is back there and with boots on, laced on, weapon ready. And then his sister got excited. She pulled out another machine gun. Brothers pulled out a few other weapons. This is one apartment on a mission base in Switzerland. And what you can see here is First World War rifle, Second World War rifle, Cold War rifle, modern rifle. So, and a sword, just for good measure. So, but that's just an average home. Despite having millions of military-type rifles and a great many other firearms and weapons of war in private homes, overall firearm abuse is so low as to be insignificant, statistically insignificant. Switzerland has the lowest burglary and murder rate in the industrial world, and home invasions are unknown. And I wonder why. You can sort of think, why would that be? How many mass murders, by the way, take place in gun shops or shooting ranges or police stations where firearms abound? This is the thing. If weapons caused crime, Switzerland would be a free fire zone disaster area. But it isn't. It's not the firearms that caused the crime. In fact, at the end of the Second World War, you had weapons all over the place. In 1945, at the end of the Second World War, tens of millions of soldiers returned to their homes, like these South Africans returning from Abyssinia. And millions of surplus firearms were sold on the open market. The South African government was selling tens of thousands of 303 rifles for just 2 rand each, and they came with a crate of ammunition free with it. 303 rifle, 2 rand, and by the way, when I bought my first firearm in 1982, my firearm license was 2 rand. And I thought, that's a bit steep for a license. And by the way, my first firearm cost me 100 rand. It was a piece of Czech rubbish. I mean, Czechoslovakian 7.62 pistol, CZ, not very high quality. So a few years later, when I'd worked at the fire brigade, I could afford a really decent weapon. I upgraded for 200 rand. I bought a Walther PPK, which has never jammed once in the 38 years or 35 years that I've had it. But imagine getting a 303 rifle and a crate of ammunition for 2 rand. Hundreds of thousands of captured souvenir weapons were brought home. People were coming back with literally piles of weapons for the field, decorating the homes with them and so on. There was actually a sharp decline of violent crime in America, Britain, South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, even though they were suddenly awash with more weapons than they'd ever had before in their lives. However, later, in the 1960s, with the advent of the permissive society, and as church attendance started to decrease, and along with the explosion of the drug culture, especially in the 60s, and in the sexual revolution, then violent crime increased. It's not the guns that caused the violence, it's the anti-Christian immorality. Clearly, guns do not cause crime any more than pencils cause misspelling. People in rebellion to the laws of God cause crime and violence. And newsflash to the liberals out there, violence predates firearms. Before the invention of gunpowder, people were getting murdered. You get rid of the guns, it doesn't mean an end to violence. Gun-free South Africa advocates imaginatively promote the dream of a country with no guns as if the suggestion of firearms magically disappearing, then violence would decrease. But if we only have gun control, we will have peace. That reveals an ignorance of both history and human nature. History records that violence was prevalent prior to the invention of firearms. In fact, it was more prevalent. Take Attila the Hun. He killed millions. Genghis Khan managed to kill 12% of the world's population with his Mongol hordes. 12% of the world's population were killed by the Mongols. Shaka Zulu, Dingaan Mzikali managed to kill millions of people, possibly up to 3 million people in the Mifikan Difikan, without firearms. The sharp and blunt facts of the matter are, contrary to the impression created by gun-free South Africa, most murders in South Africa do not involve firearms. I read the statistics from the Southern Police Service every year. Knives and other sharp objects and clubs are used to murder more South Africans than firearms do. You'd never know that from the average newspaper reports, but you get it from the police reports. Should we ban all knives? Well, a lot of kitchen work might be made a lot harder without it. Ban all sticks, ban all rocks. So I've had a few debates on TV. This was demonstrated during a TV debate I took part in with a judge who supported gun-free South Africa. Now, the interview took place downtown at the ETV studios in Cape Town. The judge, answering the question as to how he got involved in gun-free South Africa, he said, "I was involved in dealing with the brutal Baines Kloof murder some years ago. It was a terrible, gruesome murder." He said, although it didn't actually involve firearms. In fact, the terrible way in which they suffocated these people in plastic bags made him wonder whether it wouldn't have been more merciful had they been murdered by firearms. Nevertheless, he realized something had to be done to outlaw firearms. And I said to him, "I think you've proved my point." Another TV interview on SABC 2, the big question, I was dealing with Reverend Peter Story, or Reverend Alan Story, sorry, his father's Peter Story. I debated him on other occasions. This is Alan Story, the young man, of gun-free South African. When the interviewer asked me to justify my position, I quoted a number of scripture verses mandating self-defense and family defense. The interviewer then turned to Alan Story and says, "Well, Peter's quoted quite a number of verses from the Bible in support of his position. What verses from the Bible can you quote to support gun-free South Africa's position?" And Alan Story spluttered and stammered and said, "Well, actually, there aren't any. But not everything in the Bible is biblical." And as the studio audience exploded in laughter, he had, "Well, what I mean is not everything in the Bible is Christian."
What?
There's even more laughter, and I said, "What kind of theology is this?" Sometimes your opponents can destroy their own arguments better than you can. I mean, it's like he shot himself in the foot, then the knee, and then the groin. You know, how can you justify your arguments, you know, like the Bainscliffe murder and so on? So sometimes these gun-free advocates are so out of touch with reality, they don't even hear what they're saying. Some people do use firearms for evil purposes, but far more people use firearms for defensive purposes to prevent crimes from being committed. In fact, the statistic is that in the United States of America alone, where they've got a lot of these statistics, that every year about 2 million times firearms are used for self-defense to prevent a crime being committed or to defend people. But in less than 2% of the time does the firearm need to actually be fired. Merely producing the weapon normally diffuses the situation, makes them, and I've seen that certainly in my life, that merely producing a firearm can often make the other person become super reasonable and fall over themselves, getting away from the confrontation. So, and only 2% time was necessary to actually use the firearm to either injure or kill the assailant. So, plainly, firearms are used to prevent crimes more often. Now, I had another debate with Gun-Free South Africa. This is back when they actually would debate you. Another occasion, I was debating two Gun-Free South Africa advocates in Cape Town, a public meeting, and Dr. Van Us of the Red Cross Children's Hospital called for tougher gun laws because he is sick and tired of treating children wounded and crippled by gunfire. Now, this was the first time I'd heard this argument, so in trying to understand the situation, I asked a clarifying question. How many of these children are gang members or criminals who were shot by police or in self-defense by victims of their crimes? And Dr. Van Us' response was, all of them. Now, one moment he's talking about the children that he's sick and tired of treating their injuries. The next thing is, oh, well, all the children happen to be gang members. You know, like 16 and 17-year-old children and 18-year-old children and that sort of thing. And then you can have an 18-year-old policeman or soldier, but an 18-year-old child who's a criminal. You know, that's sort of, you know, when you hear child, you're thinking 8-year-old, 12-year-old, or something like that. But remember, most of the massacres in Rwanda were done by 12 to 14-year-olds. Most. Even preteens were some of the most brutal mass murderers. It's not like a 12-year-old can't murder people. And if you doubt that, you know, you could just think of Blood Diamonds and Sierra Leone and Liberia and so on. But the Interahamwe people, Rwanda, 12 to 14-year-olds did most of the murders. So late upon investigation, I contacted Red Cross and got the stats. Only 4 patients a month at Red Cross Children's Hospital were gunshot victims. Almost all of those were from illegal guns in the hands of gangsters. Numerous of the patients themselves were actually gangsters themselves. Now, this led me to want to find out more details about, you know, what injuries are children suffering. So it does not seem logical to disarm licensed firearm owners when they're not even the problem. But further research revealed the vast majority of casualties admitted to Red Cross Hospital in that year were to falls, 2,338 cases of injuries, trauma caused by falls. Motor vehicle accidents, 1,030. Burns, 532. Assault with blunt or sharp instruments, over 200. Poisoning, 744. Even dog bites were more numerous than firearm wounds. There were 50 firearm wounds for that year. There were 91 dog bites in that year. So Dr. Van Us was giving the impression that the biggest problem in Red Cross Children's Hospital for any doctors dealing with firearm wounds, and meanwhile, almost all of them were gangsters, and in any case, it was the smallest category of trauma that they had to deal with in Red Cross Hospital. Vastly more children die each year from bicycle accidents, car accidents, and drownings than from firearms. Children are far more likely to die of a car accident than from a firearm. Now, just take your American. Okay, traffic accidents, firearm accidents, traffic accidents, firearm accidents. I mean, you know, all the other things stuck in by machinery and things like that. And so drowning is vastly greater threat, burns from firing and suffocation and all that sort of thing. So you can see really and truly when they're trying to make out the biggest threat to your children is a firearm, not actually. Should we outlaw all motor vehicles? I mean, let's face it. Probably one of the most dangerous things you do is driving in a car or cycling in a road. And In fact, statistically, the greatest threat to life of missionaries is vehicle accidents. Far more than landmines, bombings, ambushes, all the other things. Forget snakes and wild animals and crocodiles. That's statistically insignificant. The biggest danger, in fact, I know a lot of missionaries who've died in vehicle accidents. We lost one of our missionaries to a vehicle accident. Vehicle accidents, and because the huge amount of driving on some of the worst roads in the world, makes motor vehicles, and I hope you pray every time you get in a vehicle, because you should. The solution to the horrific carnage on the roads is not to ban motor vehicles, but to improve safety vehicles in the vehicles, and to educate the drivers better, and to promote the use of seatbelts, and to severely punish drunken or reckless driving. Do you know the vast majority of vehicle accidents, the driver is under the influence of alcohol or drugs? Here's another one. Do you know the vast majority of murders in South Africa take place on Friday and Saturday nights? In and around places where alcohol is served, shebeens and bars and so on. If you are not out on Friday and Saturday nights in and around a area where there's alcohol served or drugs, you are statistically greatly improved in not becoming a victim. So just something like that. Most drownings, alcohol related. Most domestic violence, alcohol related. Most people killed, bicycles, pedestrians, all the way through railway accidents, alcohol and drug related. So, and now I suppose cell phone use would come in also rising up there, causing a lot of vehicle accidents. As with motor vehicles, it wouldn't be right to erode everyone's rights or take away everyone's freedom because of the criminal activity and lawlessness of some. You know, if guns kill people, then cars drive drunk and pencils misspell words and spoons made Oprah Winfrey fat. If we don't blame cars for drunk drivers, why blame guns for violent people? So guns protect the president and all the members of parliament and celebrities and so on and so forth. So why would you defend your children with a "this is a gun-free zone" sign? The average response time to an emergency call for the flying squad is 23 minutes. Responsive time to a 357 is 1,400 feet per second. Which is faster? People who are doing new maths might struggle with that answer. Now, imagine some shooters coming to a school and saying, "Oh, it's a gun-free zone. Ah, drats. What do we do now?" Signs can't stop acts of violence. Armed citizens can. So what would you prefer? A gun control advocate says a teacher holding up a "this is a gun-free zone," a "drug-free zone," or a teacher who's armed and trained. Yeah, which do you think is more effective? Do you know police used to come to the schools to teach gun safety? Well, that's in America. In Rhodesia, we had the army come to our schools and teach us gun safety and how to handle them. We were taught in 2-2 rifles, and Fridays were great. Fridays would be cadets and marching around and shooting and all that stuff. It was, you know, so we learned at school how to handle firearms. Never heard of a firearm accident in Rhodesia. So I spoke to a policeman who's older than me, who'd been a BSAP all his life, all through the years in Rhodesia. "Did you ever hear of firearm accidents in Rhodesia?" He said, "Nope." I said, "Really? Didn't even hear of one." It didn't happen in his knowledge. And yet the guns were everywhere. They're propped up by the door. They were above the fireplace. They were in the cubbyhole. All over the place. We had firearms everywhere. Teachers carried them at schools. But everyone was taught to respect firearms and knew how to handle them. And so it wasn't a big problem. Guns don't kill people. Planned Parenthood and Mary Stopes kill people. And we're planning, by the way, next Tuesday night to show a film on how abortion was legalized in America, Roe v. Wade. For those who are interested, Tuesday night. Liberals are so fond of saying, if you don't like abortion, don't have an abortion. So why don't they take their own advice and apply that to guns and religion? And if they don't want a gun, then don't get a gun. But don't ban everyone else from getting it. I mean, how come they can't have the same kind of logic? It's my body, my choice. Okay, well, it's my body, my choice. I don't want the vaccination or to wear a mask. No, you all got to get the vaccination. Now, those who believe in a woman's right to choose, well, 15 million women in America have decided to own a firearm. Don't they have the right to choose? You may not like guns, you may choose not to own a gun. You may not like God, and you may choose to exclude God. But if someone breaks into your home, there's two things you're going to do. You're going to call someone with a gun, and you're going to pray they get there in time. And that's the fact. All these liberals. And one question you could say to these people who bring this wall up, obviously they're afraid of dying, which is valid. If you were to die today, do you know where you would spend eternity? Would you go to heaven or hell? I think if they bring up the subject of guns and death, let's bring up the subject of eternity and salvation. Armed citizens save lives. Every day, countless crimes are prevented, hundreds of potential victims are protected, many tragedies are averted by armed citizens. John Lott, who was a pro-gun control advocate, who was anti-gun, did a study which went into decades, 18 years, and he produced the book More Guns, Less Crime. And he was shocked by the facts after analyzing thousands of counties over 18 years, and he saw the more legal guns were in a society, the more crime fell. I mean, newsflash to the liberals. And literally, year by year, you see the as they were able to get more guns in the community, the crime went down. And this is the way it is. And here's different countries, and you can see how in black, it is gun deaths per 100,000 people, and in brown, guns owned per 100 people. So plainly, there's not necessarily a correlation, such as Brazil's got more violence, even though they've got less guns. But you see, it's not the issue of the guns in Japan. Well, they use swords to chop one another up, so, you know. And there's all kinds of... His book is just absolutely overwhelming with facts showing that, in fact, the more legal guns are in society, the more crime goes down, violence goes down, murders go down, and so on. Armed citizens save lives. Unarmed citizens all too often become helpless victims. Case in point, Exhibit A, St. James Church of England, 25th of July, 1993, five terrorists attacked St. James Church in Kenilworth. Within seconds, they'd killed 11 people and they had injured over 50. And lives were saved because of Jared Harker, 21-year-old, who leapt on a hand grenade and absorbed the full impact of the grenade in himself to save the people on both sides of the aisle. Because Charles van Wyk, at the back of the church, opened fire with his .38 revolver from a distance of approximately 50 meters and wounded in the hand the terrorist who was shooting, Makai McCormack, and they broke off the attack at that point. And Charles went out the back door of the church, saw them standing by the car with their weapons ready to obviously get people as they fled out the church doors in panic, and he fired at them again, and then they fled. I've got the story of that in our security and survival handbook as well. But the proposed new gun legislation is unnecessary, it's unconstitutional, it is counterproductive. It is every citizen's right and duty to be armed and prepared to defend the innocent and to defend the defenseless. Courage is contagious. Fear is also contagious, as you've seen during this coronavirus scare. Panic is more contagious than corona. When a brave man takes a stand, though, the spines of others are often stiffened too. Life is a fight. We shouldn't let it overwhelm us. We need to adapt, and we need to combat every situation that's thrown at us. From the earliest, I've trained our boys to know you've got to grow up to defend your sisters, your mom, your future wife, and we've made sure they've got weapons and been trained in martial sports. It's important to have martial sports, to know how to fight, whether unarmed or with weapons, to have the discipline, to have the skills, to overcome. And I've made sure my daughters know how to fight too, because not all the males out there are being real men. And a family that shoots together stays together. And we need to aim to please. And it's super important that we know how to fight. We're in a dangerous world, in a dangerous time, and so it's vital that we acquire the skills needed. Combat training, taking out targets like computer screens and TVs. It's part of our Great Commission course as well. Do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, great and awesome. Fight for your brethren, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your houses. Now, what I've given you, all the text is one of the chapters in Security and Survival Handbook, Faith and Firearms, and you'll get more details on this. We'll upload the video and audio of it on frontlinemissionsa.org website. So, any questions, any comments, complaints, or criticisms? Yes?
Isn't it interesting that they're trying to remove guns before they do the expropriation of the land in South Africa?
In fact, they can't do the one without the other. Because you try to take away people's livelihood, at a certain point they're going to fight. And so disarming is a key part of it. But you know, the incredible thing is when they started the Firearm Control Act 1999, the amount of people I know who rushed to the police station to hand their firearms over. Now, here's the interesting thing. I know some of these people. And so this one man, he heard about the Firearm Control Act, and he wanted to keep his pistols, but he went and he handed in his AK-47s. Now, he had a couple of AK-47s that he picked up on the border, you know, shopping, preemptive raids. So he went and handed them in under one of the amnesties, and he got a certificate, you know, decommissioned, they're going to destroy it and so on. His AK-47s have been destroyed, and he's got... Well, later, police come to him, a few years later, to arrest him, because his AK-47s were used in a armed robbery heist. Now, he has a certificate. They were destroyed by the police, but the firearms are still in use. Obviously, the people who destroyed them sold them into the criminal market. There's a case of a policeman who lost his firearm four times, and he's still a policeman. He had his fifth gun, and then they finally tracked it down that he was selling his police firearm to criminals and keeping the money. How do you stay a police while you've lost your firearm? In the army, I mean, the worst thing you could do is to lose your firearm. But it's worse than that. There are so many cases of people who have handed in their firearms, which have later turned up being used in crime. So basically, the police lose firearms faster than the general population. So people handing in their firearms to the police are actually ensuring that criminals get hold of their firearms at a greater rate than they could if they just kept them in their safe at home or on their person or whatever is the way they deal with it. The situation is really bizarre. If all the sheep pass resolutions in favor of vegetarianism, it doesn't change the mind of the wolf. You know, it doesn't matter if all the people with a conscience abstain from violence, because the people without a conscience will just do what they want. The only way to stop a bad man with a gun is a good man with a gun. Or a good woman. Yes?
Dr. Just the details of the new bill in contrast to what was proposed
No difference. It's the same thing that they were doing in 99. Basically, what they were trying to do in 1999 was say that self-defense is not a reason to own a firearm. Now, I'd anticipated this way back in the 80s, that this might come, so I joined a combat shooting club, a target shooting club, so I had good reason to have rifles, shotgun, pistols, and so on. And I knew that those, even in countries with strict gun control, you could keep guns if you parts of that sort of thing, and you've got your memberships. But self-defense, they were trying to scrap. Now, we beat them on that one. Now they're coming back, and it's basically the same thing. They're trying to say, okay, if you're a hunter, you can have a firearm. If you're, but you can't have a firearm for self-defense. Now, for example, okay, if you're a hunter, you've got a rifle, say. It's not great help when you're driving in a car and someone's trying to hijack you in the car. An average woman can't be handling a shotgun as she's going shopping. You know, we need to have small compact weapons for self-defense in the average hijacking scenario. And that's what they're trying to say. Well, there's no need for it. Well, just on an important point here, do you know that in the budget this year, the government has defunded the police by 4 billion rand, so 4 billion rand less for police protecting us. But they increased VIP police protection by 2 billion. So they're increasing their protection for members of Parliament who are passing this law, they're decreasing our protection and at the same time coming up with a law that we can't even defend ourselves. So that's pretty pathetic. So when a person comes out with, they support this, I think the first thing is, we'll lead by example. Scrap the VIP police, scrap security around Parliament, scrap all the armed securities for the people making these laws. They mustn't have bodyguards and there must be no police details. Because if they say we don't need defense, then they shouldn't either. If we can't have guns for self-defense, why should they have guns for self-defense? But this is the point. You take the man who is running Gun-Free South Africa. He had an armed response company signs on his gates and around his wall. That's a bit hypocritical. If you don't believe in guns for self-defense, why are you paying other people to protect you? And yeah, so these are just some arguments you can use.
Just sorry, a follow-up question. If it was found to be unconstitutional in 1999, what would change the outcome now? So if that was the outcome when the similar bill was passed, why try this on law, and what grounds do you...
Well, they're assuming a lot of the old guard have died, a lot of new people who've been through the indoctrination gulags of the state schools, people have been watching SATV and might have been lobotomized as far as thinking goes. Of course, we've had corona panic, pandemic, fear-mongering for the last 15 months to distract people. I think they might think they've got a better chance this time than what they had back in 1999. So this is just round two. That's okay. Same arguments that defeated them then, including it being unconstitutional, I believe we can do again. But remember, the price of vigilance, price of liberty is eternal vigilance. All that is necessary for evil to triumph is for good people to do nothing. Yes?
I just want to mention about also Congo and the story of rebels in Congo, how they come into like villages because guns for citizens is like illegal in Congo, like very few people, and you have like generals and the police and stuff like that, and they have protection all the time. But then these rebels come into the community, small villages, kill fathers and stuff, take little girls as slaves, take young boys as their future soldiers, so they basically train children soldiers, and those children torture people to death from like 10 to like 14. And those children, after like a while, they come back into those same villages and kill people, not actually knowing, but maybe other people, I think, forgotten what happened. And then the girls are like their sex slaves that have more kids, and it's just a whole messed up situation where the police always comes 24 hours later, you know, the whole mess has been done, people are dead and stuff like that. And like, as you think about it, the best thing the government could do for the people is to arm the fathers and the parents in the community. Because they always say when these things are happening, and it's really sad.
Yes, I mean, just take another basis that we had a massive problem with piracy on the seas just recently. And now they've had to put weapons back on ships. Well, obviously, piracy was a massive problem in the 1600s and so on, and it only came to an end by the Royal Navy having the practice of arming every merchant vessel with cannons and all the rest, and every merchant vessel had means of defense. And now you had the ridiculous case like the Captain Phillips film, demonstrate, where you've got this how many billion dollar tanker with all these containers on it, and they didn't have one weapon. And there's a little speedboat with four people with AK-47s managed to hijack this multi-billion dollar ship, and these poor guys are just using hose pipes and flares. It's just shame. I looked at this and I thought, if this is in any way real and accurate, what an absolute disgrace. That what are they thinking? You're putting all this very valuable equipment without any means of protection, open seas, it's an open invitation to piracy. The only way piracy was beaten in the past was by effective defense of the ships, and it's the only way it's going to be done now. But now they've got all kinds of different rules, but basically they're having to put armed men, mercenaries, on virtually every ship to prevent piracy. That's the way it goes. At one point, they wouldn't allow you to have weapons on planes. And, of course, then planes got hijacked. So now the American planes are going the same way as what the Israelis. The Israelis years ago put armed Mossad people on every plane to be able to shoot any potential hijacker. And now Americans have what they call sky marshals who are on the planes. So they've got armed people now on the planes. But most of you are disarmed. But if we were operating like Rhodesia did, in Rhodesia, we used to walk onto the plane without any security checks, and there was the air hostesses. We had air hostesses then, it's before flight attendants. And would you please ensure that your firearms are safe and securely holstered, and please place all machine guns, rifles, and overhead compartments? And that wasn't a joke. That was genuine. And, you know, flying internal flights in Rhodesia, if you're going to Victoria Falls or going to Kariba and between Bulawayo and Salisbury and Matari. And so, you know, people lugging their rifles and machine guns on the planes, and, you know, nobody ever hijacked an Air Rhodesia. Yes?
Is there any sort of massive increase in people buying guns whenever, specifically in America, whenever they start, you know, crying out about, oh, we got to disarm you guys?
Yes.
Because I think I've heard they have a trillion rounds of ammunition in America, because every time they're threatened to take the guns, they go straight to the gun shop.
They do. So my friends in America, say that the best gun salesmen in America have been Clinton and Obama, and now Biden. So they said during these bad presidents' times, the gun sellers are just having a wild time. People are pouring in there. They're coming with shopping trolleys, and they're loading on crates of ammo. So it's kind of, and this is the thing. If they really tried to disarm them, there's a lot of people who have this. You can take my gun out of my cold, dead hands, you know. And you see those bumper stickers all over the place. And there are people like Charlton Heston who made this. Charlton Heston lived in Los Angeles. And Los Angeles made it illegal to own a firearm. And he was, I've got this massive gun safe. I've got 50 cals. I've got a 45 Colt by my bed. If anyone wants and comes and takes it, they can get out of my cold, dead hand. You know, I'm going to kill as many of you first before you take it from me. And that, I mean, Charlton Heston, you know, he's a well-known international star, and he's living in Los Angeles. So, you know, come and get them. By the way, that's a famous saying from the Spartans. You know, the 300 Spartans, when they were told to hand over the weapons, the famous answer that they gave back in Greek is, come and get them. And so that, I've seen a lot of people using Greek words for that. Come and get them. And so Charlton Heston repopularized that again.
So also in America, I think there's a good argument for them actually, really, even if the entire military was turned against them. Because I've seen, you know, their videos of hunting hogs. They got night vision, they got incredible rifles. I mean, it's not much different to what a military has.
Yes.
They could just put a little spring on it and it'll make it automatic fire.
Yes. So, for example, during the war in Sudan, I would go visiting America, and they'd take you to these army surplus stores, and it was, wow, like being a kid in a toy store and a candy store. And I was picking up night sight equipment and all sorts of great things. They've got army manuals on everything from for the rangers and for medics and for whatever. And so I'd scoop up these manuals, and I'd scoop up night sights, and I'd go back to there, and I'd equip the commanders, you know, come there bearing gifts. You always come to, you give them nice knives and binoculars and night sights. And there was no night sights. Nobody had night sights there in the Espile. So we were able to equip a lot, made a lot of good friends, and give them manuals on some of the finest things. It's an open market in America. So, but night sights in wars in Africa, often wars come to an end at night because of lack of that. But this is one of the great advantages, like cats at night. They can see better than anyone else, so they're out there hunting at night. If you've got night sights, your advantage is huge.
And GPS.
Yes. That's not something I've tended to use, but some of our people have. I still use maps. Yes, Henry.
I've got two questions. Firstly, the gun associations currently active, which ones would you recommend? And secondly,
GOSA, Gun Owners of South Africa.
Not SAGA.
SAGA's okay. But they were willing to accept too many things of what the government was saying. For example, back in 1999, they were willing to accept all the restrictions that they were coming, but they were wanting better situation for the hunters and sportsmen. Like, this isn't about hunting and sporting. This is about self-defense. And so SAGA was positioned overwhelmingly on the tourism and hunting. And so we started GOSA as the fighting for the right of every single citizen to have a weapon for self-defense. And so GOSA is a more... Now, SAGA's achieved a lot of good things, but we thought that they weren't fighting for all the rights of everyone enough. They were plainly better funded by the tourism industry, which includes the hunting industry and so on. So I was repelled by that, and we moved into GOSA, and GOSA has eclipsed SAGA in terms of impact and effect. And for example, when I was applying for my relicensing, and you've got this firearm control officer who is asking you, I mean, I've got a shotgun. He says, is this an automatic? No, it's a pump action shotgun. Is that automatic? No, it's manual. I mean, this is a firearm control officer, and so on. And he's asking me questions about the firearm. Now, he's meant to be checking me out, and I'm informing him he doesn't know these weapons as well. And there's some things are very scary. And we had, for example, a Cape Practical Pistol Club on Slopes of Devil's Peak. And so we had to pay for someone from Pretoria to come over to evaluate. There's apparently no one in Cape to come and evaluate. So this this farm control officer comes to register our shooting range, which has always only been for pistol, and we had one longer range for shotgun. And he's going around, he says, you know, he's ticking everything and so on, asking questions, which just indicate he knew nothing about them. So one question is, how thick is your backstop? So the man says, well, it's Table Mountain, you know? Well, how thick is it? He said, I don't know, kilometers. And he says, well, I need to know exactly how thick your backstop is. Is it over 3 meters? And he says, significantly, yes. And it carried on. And in the end, he had to say, yes, it's thick. He had to give the amount, something like 3 meters or whatever. So, you know, man couldn't comprehend the fact that Devil's Peak is thicker than the average backstop and quite adequate to stop the bullet going through and killing someone half bay. But at the end, he marked, instead of what we'd always had was pistol range, and then there's one shotgun range. He marked them all for pistol, shotgun, and rifle. Every one on the range. And so suddenly we had legally the right to use rifles in this pistol range and so on. You're like, wow. Well, we're not arguing, but this is the kind of thing. You've got people who are there to test your competence. And I was trained in the army and the infantry, for goodness sakes, and I've got someone who doesn't know which is an automatic and what's a manual, and he's there evaluating your competency. So the situations are false. But that's why, you know, we've got to fight this nonsense. Plainly, they're trying to wear people out so that we'll stop fighting. But we need to remind ourselves that we can beat them on these things. Take the hate speech bill. The hate speech bill, they were trying to make it completely illegal for you to say anything that could offend anyone, including LGBT and all that. And we fought that until they finally put in a religious exclusion and conscience exclusion, exemption specifically, which took the teeth out of it. Now we're fighting a similar bill that they're trying to bring out again a few years later, a new equity bill. It's PAPUDA. I've got, for those who are interested, I've got some letters that we've written on this new bill, which is a threat to our constitutional freedoms. Department of Justice and Constitutional Development. And they're trying to pass a bill. We've got till the end of June to respond. Encourage people to send in letters about it. We'll be dealing with this on radio. And anyway, I'll put this over there for folks to take if you want some examples. But the price of liberty is eternal vigilance. Any other questions, comments?
There's a second question.
Yes?
Yeah, so what you mentioned second? That you guys fought the fight, and I know that the green carded gun license was upheld, and no, anyone that did not renew their license but just kept the old green card, which had no expiry date, could legally keep their firearm. Is that still the case, or has that been overturned?
As far as I know, that is still the case. And of course, they will be fighting for that right now, too. So, there we go. We're just getting ready to show you a trailer for the Roe v. Wade film that we're wanting to show next week, Tuesday.
I think you should put in the precaution and the warnings,
yes,
about the Roe v. Wade.
Yes, correct. So, Roe v. Wade is a film that we've acquired. It was released in April of this year, 2021, in America. It's a big screen epic, $6.8 million budget. John Voight, who's a major character in Hollywood and a friend of Trump, won a Best Actor Award from the Vienna Independent Films Awards earlier this year. And this is not a Christian film, though. Unlike Unplanned, it's not a Christian film. It's a secular film told from the perspective of the number one abortionist, Dr. Bernard Nathanson, who said he had performed 70,000 abortions. And he was the head of the National Alliance for the Repeal of Abortion Legislation, NARAL.
And that's 1970s.
Yes, 1970s. And he, in his testimony, is basically letting us know, we lied about everything. And it wasn't just us lying, a national organization of women lying, and it wasn't just NARAL sucking statistics out of our thumb and completely lying. But the media execs and editors were deliberately perpetuating the lies knowingly to advance legalization of abortion. And there was also lying done by members of the Supreme Court two of whom had families members working in Planned Parenthood. So one of the Supreme Court justices, his wife was working for Planned Parenthood. Another one had his daughter working for Planned Parenthood, which is serious conflicts of interest. But it's a well put together, it's a well-made film, but it lacks a gospel Christian heart like Unplanned. Therefore, I didn't feel satisfied to show it at a Reformation Society meeting or at the ACA conference that we planned. But we do believe it should come to the cinemas because, like Gosnell and like Unplanned, it's an excellent film exposé on the reality of abortion, and I think it will win a lot of people over to it. Because Bernard Nathanson came to oppose abortion, and he's converted into being a pro-life activist, but he didn't become an evangelical Christian. He converted to becoming a Catholic. And the film does depict that. So the only religion that's a bit of Catholicism, right down to statues of Mary and candles and so on. But so it's not satisfying from a Christian perspective, but it's extremely powerful in terms of exposing the duplicity and deception of the pro-abortion industry. So if anyone wants to, bearing in mind that it's got some hard scenes and some uncomfortable scenes, violence of abortion and so on, and these are pagan people. But there is no nudity, there's no swearing, the violence is abortion violence. I don't know that that is any worse than Unplanned, but it lacks the gospel redemption at the end, which we got in Unplanned. Therefore, so it's a film recommended with caution for those who want or those involved in a fight against abortion. I believe if we can get into the big screens, we can recruit a lot of people who right now are on the fence over to the pro-life side. Because, in fact, watching it at first, we're wondering, is this film pro-life or pro-abortion? Because it's being told from the perspective of someone who is promoting the abortion industry. And it takes a while to fully see where it's going, but it knocks a serious heavyweight punch against the abortion industry and media.